Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, and pleased to have with me in the studio today two guests, Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension horticulture educator, and Brian Huddleston. Brian has been with us a number of times as well, plant disease diagnostician with the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic at UW-Madison and UW Extension. So happy to have them along, and certainly you can join in with your gardening questions at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Lisa, nice to have you back.
Hey, thanks for asking me.
And Brian, great to see you again.
Good
as well.
Good to see you too, Larry.
Lisa, what kinds of questions are you getting these days from homeowners?
Well, we're getting things about closing the garden down for the winter. Mm-hmm. We're still getting some questions about emerald ash borer. And we're still getting, what can I do to prevent Japanese beetle next year? I wish that I had a silver bullet for that one, but, and you know, those sorts of things. Oh, and of course, the lady beetles and the box elder bugs, back in October were a big, big deal trying to find space in your house to overwinter. So
plenty to talk about. You know, you mentioned the Japanese beetles, and we have a rugosa rose bush at home, plant at home, and the Japanese beetles eliminated the flowers mm-hmm. right away. But we had another bloom, and it just ended a couple days ago, as a matter of fact. So we had five big, beautiful roses on that plant, and no Japanese beetles.
Isn't
it was
that
great.
Wonderful?
Oh, man. Brian, what about you? What are you hearing from people?
Right now we're getting a lot of conifer samples coming in, which is what we typically see at this time of the year. Folks are seeing carryovers from what was going on in the summer, and they're wanting to find out what's going on. And actually had some interesting samples come in from Florida today. We sometimes get out-of-state samples. Oh. And have a consultant who works the summers here in Wisconsin and then goes the winters to Florida and consults down there and sent me some cabbage samples, which I don't see a lot of. But it was kind of interesting, a bacterial disease on cabbage.
Ooh, nice smelly.
No, they were actually pretty intact. They hadn't totally slimified yet, so they look pretty good.
So you have a friend who gets to work summers here and the winters in Florida.
It's a consultant here in the state, and that's, that doesn't sound terribly fair, but definitely that would be a way to do it.
Oh, man. Well, every line's filled, so let's go to the phones. Don and Boaz, you are up. Thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to ask this about, it has to do with seed saving. I had a marvelous crop of butternut squash this year. Some of them were very large. So I saved three of the biggest seeds from three of the biggest ones, hoping that I could duplicate those plants next year. Right now, they're in a plastic bag in my refrigerator. And I want you to tell me what I should do, if anything, to make those viable for planting next spring.
You have a problem.
Yes, you do have a problem. Just to give you an idea, it takes a bee about 12 visits to a squash flower to get it totally pollinated. And you don't know where that bee, what other squash plants or so on the bee has pollinated. And the problem with saving squash seeds is that probably what you're going to get fruit-wise is going to look like something from outer space. That's a quote from Karen Delahoe. You are not likely to get something that looks like a butternut even necessarily. So I would take those seeds, unfortunately, and file them in the round file.
I will do that.
Yeah. Sorry.
If you have the room, you might try.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you are interested in experimenting, go ahead and plant them somewhere. You know, don't expect a lot. But you
send us a picture.
Youngs and buy some new plants next spring.
Yeah, that's the easiest thing.
I have seen sometimes plants come up from seed that yield kind of interesting squash, and they taste okay. And
sometimes they're not so great. So it's kind of a
toss of the dice, but definitely if you're interested in experimenting,
miss,
try
but
it.
Mostly miss.
Yeah.
All right. Carl and Madison, hello to you.
Hello. Yes, I'm a first-time caller, a fairly regular listener.
Great.
Unfortunately, not much of a gardener. I've got a space in the front yard where we used to have a magnolia tree that died of some kind of disease that attacked our neighbor's larger magnolia. And so my boys and I this past spring decided that we would put something new there, and in honor of Mother's Day, we put a, I think it's called a snow crab.
Snow crab apple tree, sure.
Yeah, and it's probably 7 feet high, was probably 6 feet high or so when we put it in. And the leaves were green and did everything I guess we were supposed to do putting it in. But we noticed about midway through the summer that about 20% of the leaves were getting this lacy-like holes. And this may be a very common question.
Yeah, yeah.
I just don't know what we put on there or do for it to limit whatever that is.
Yeah, it's probably a bug, I bet. Japanese beetle,
that
maybe?
That would be
my
guess.
That's my thought, too,
yeah.
Yes.
And I wish I could tell you that I had a good solution for that. Since it is only the leaves, you can apply a product that is called either Merit or Bayer's Advanced Home. Oh, boy, let's see. It's got this big, long name. Advanced, it's like tree and lawn care. You'd have to ask at the store. It comes in a blue container. The active ingredient is imidacloprid, and you can put that on as a soil drench, and it will protect the leaves. You need to put it on earlier than when the Japanese beetles show up, because trees need to take it up into their canopy, and you can use that to protect the leaves.
And
now,
so what time of year would that be you'd put it on?
I would go ahead and put it on in, say, April.
Okay.
Because the Japanese beetles, you know, they don't show up until usually around the 1st of July or the last week in June. Now, I wish that approach would work on your roses, Larry, but all that it will do is protect the leaves.
Yeah, we're very committed to this tree. It's it represents Mother's Day, but also our dog's ashes are sprinkled around
Aww.
It. We kind of hope Aww. It sticks. So,
yeah.
All right, well, I will try these products, and thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling. And just to take it a one step further, can you apply that to, say, a cherry tree or a tree where you might be getting the fruit off of it?
I don't think it's labeled for trees with edible crops.
No.
And that means that if you're growing a crab apple and have the habit of harvesting the crab apples and doing anything with those, you wouldn't want to use this product either.
That's a very good point. I think the gentleman was talking about spring snow, which is
fruitless.
But he might not be. So that's
sure.
That's a real good point.
Actually, I think the crab apple was probably a good selection for what he was talking about, having problems with his magnolia, because mm-hmm. I suspect he probably had a problem with verticillium wilt in that area.
Yeah, I was wondering
and
about
crab
that, too.
Apples are a fairly mm-hmm. good replacement in an area where that's a problem.
Yeah. So good luck to you, Carl. Thanks. Appreciate the call very much. Ralph in Ashland, we're on to you now. Hi, Ralph.
Hi. I am wondering if you have any new news. Our biggest crop in our big garden is probably raising, 5 to 6 dozen tomato plants. And we've tried the resistant varieties, but still it seems like, I believe, alternaria blight is a real problem. We've tried mulching, really tilling. I don't use fungicides. That's the only thing. I've tried different spots instead of our regular garden spot. And I'm at my wit's end with it. Like I say, we really do depend on all of the tomato products we make. Do you have anything for me?
Yeah, you're probably dealing with one of two diseases. One of the ones that you mentioned is early blight, which is an alternaria disease. And then the other common one that we see in a lot of home gardens is something called septoria leaf spot. And they both function in very similar ways. These fungi survive in little bits of leaf debris that are in the soil. And they produce spores in the spring when it's wet and moist, or wet and cool. And then those spores are either splashed up or blow up onto the lower leaves. And that's what starts the disease. And you'll see a defoliation of the plant from the bottom up. Are those the sorts of symptoms that you're seeing? Let's check to make sure we're dealing with the right disease first.
Yeah, it is. Although it does seem that warm, moist weather really devastating.
Yeah, you get a lot more sporulation as we get in farther into the summer, but definitely,
sure.
Definitely it sounds like you're dealing with those types of diseases, and really our recommendations for control are the same for either one of those. Basically what you've been doing, good fall cleanup, so make sure you get rid of as much of the old tomato debris as you possibly can. I would recommend trying to move your tomatoes to a new location in your yard if you can do that. That's not a great control strategy, but it's just something I normally recommend in general in vegetable gardens, is moving things around. The other thing is to space your plants as far apart as you possibly can. You want to get very good airflow in between the plants so that if the leaves get wet, they dry quickly. And then mulch around the base of the plants. And what that will do is provide a physical barrier to prevent those spores from splashing up or blowing up onto the leaves of your new plants. Definitely do not sprinkle irrigate. If you're using a sprinkler, you're getting the leaves wet, and that's going to make a more favorable environment for these sorts of organisms to get established. You want to use something like a soaker hose or a drip hose at the base of the plant. And then other than that, I can't recommend too much more. I sometimes recommend with folks, if they're having real serious problems, actually growing tomatoes in large pots so that you can really space them far apart and actually move them to different locations in your lawn. Sometimes that can help a little bit. There are fungicides for control, but I normally don't recommend those for homeowners. I tell folks, if you've got to go through all the expense and effort to apply fungicides onto your tomatoes, you might as well go to a local farmer that grows them and buy them there.
Buy them there, yeah.
Yeah.
And that this whole spacing thing, I think, is really
And thinning could be something you could try as well, which would be to judiciously take out some of the branches or leaves to just kind of open up the canopy and allow for better airflow. Because both of the organisms that cause these diseases, they require what are called leaf wetness periods. It's a period where there's a thin layer of water on the leaf. The fungus needs that. Its spores will not germinate and infect unless there's that water. And so anything you can do to limit the amount of time that the leaves are wet is going to help.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling.
Appreciate it very much.
And we do have fact sheets on both of these diseases for anyone who's interested. If they go to our UW Extension Horticulture website, which is wihort.uwex.edu, and click on the Wisconsin Garden Facts. That'll take you to our one-page fact sheets and look for early blight and septoria leaf spot.
Very good. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much for calling. Most of the tomato plantings I see, including my own in the past, it looks like a jungle. You know, all the plants are kind of growing together. I mean, when you first plant them, it looks like, well, that should be far enough apart.
Yeah, but they look so spindly, and you know.
But not by the time the blight set in, no. Unfortunately, no.
Unfortunately,
the one saving grace for the blights is that they don't get onto the fruits typically. So if you're seeing spots on the tomato fruits, it's actually another set of diseases. There are some bacterial diseases that we've seen, and those do spot the fruits.
Yeah, Don in La Crosse, on to you now. Hi, Don.
Hi. I'm a new homeowner, and I just sodded my lawn last year.
Okay.
And I have two dogs, and they kind of have killed it with going to the bathroom out there.
Yeah.
And I want to have it fixed up next year. I'm wondering what would be my best approach, if I could do some kind of a seeding now, and like a dormant seed or something like that, or if you guys have any suggestions for what to do with the dogs.
I've got some ideas on the dogs.
Now we need Patricia McConnell.
I've learned a lot from Patricia, and the one thing on the dogs is you teach your dogs to go in one spot, and you find a corner of the lawn or the area, and you give them a nice place that looks like, you know, it's kind of maybe there's a little bit of soil worked up there, and you go in there and you have them go there. And then they're not going all over the lawn. The other thing on them, I believe, is if they're going all over the lawn, about the only thing you can do is water, run out there afterwards with a hose.
Could dilute things.
And dilute it down. But that's just not practical for most in most cases. Mm-hmm. But why am I talking? Here, let me go to Lisa. Lisa, you're the expert here. Hey, Brian.
Okay, you're in La Crosse. I'm not a big fan of dormant seeding myself, not this late in the year and not where you're located, because the weather is really pretty unpredictable at this time of year. I would wait until spring and then do your seeding. You say you've done sod already?
I have brand new sod in that.
Okay. Yeah, you know, see what comes up next spring and then overseed with whatever mix is recommended for your area. And then, again, as we were saying, make sure that you train the dogs to go somewhere else.
Does the whole lawn, I mean, are you sure it's the dogs?
Well, it's kind of, you can
or is
kind
it
of
the spots here and there.
Then where they run along the fence.
Okay, So it is the dogs. All right.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it.
I heard to maybe put pea gravel down in a quarter of the lawn or something for the dogs.
Oh, that's kind of small. I would. I've seen people use like, you know, inch and a half, but Larry, maybe you have.
Yeah, well, you want someplace that's comfortable for the dog. So pea gravel actually would, you know,
probably
is fine.
Be
but actually, if you just cleared a spot and kept it open, that works just as well.
Yeah.
That could, in fact, work better because they can dig around in there too a little bit if they want to.
All right, well, thank you.
All right, thanks for calling. Lou in Milwaukee, we'll get to you in just a minute. But just to remind you who are listening, Lisa Johnson, one of our guests, the other Brian Huddleston from the UW Extension here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Give us a call with your gardening questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And when you call in, Jim Packard, our producer, who is here pretty much every single day with a smile on his face and that lovely deep voice, is there to handle your questions and move them along. So glad to have Jim, obviously. Lou in Milwaukee, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Lou.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I had a bad year with bugs this year, but I noticed my sedums were beautiful. My question is, apparently the bugs don't like sedums. How do I get essence of sedum so I can water my other plants with and have them soak it up so the bugs don't eat them?
Oh, man.
Oh, that's an interesting thought. There are actually some insects that do get sedum, like aphids I've seen. I'm wondering which insects you're talking about that were giving you the problem. Was it Japanese beetle? Was it...
I don't know which insects they were, but whatever insects, they did not touch the sedum, whatever they were. It might have been a variety of them.
Okay.
Apparently, bugs don't like sedum.
Well, some bugs don't like
sedum.
Yeah,
some don't. Again, the aphids can be a problem.
On sedum.
Yeah, on sedum. And there are some other insects that can cause problems. Were you seeing damage in that leaves were being eaten?
Yes,
or?
My hostas were just eaten up.
Okay, that's probably slugs. And there are various products you can use for slugs. There's a product called Sluggo, which is iron phosphate, little pellets. And you can apply that to the soil early in the season. And since it's ingredients that would be found in the soil naturally, it's not as big a problem as some of the poison products like metaldehyde that is a little bit more on the toxic side. You can also use some of the more organic products such as diatomaceous earth, which it's a little powdery material that you sprinkle around to keep the slugs from climbing up on the hosta.
Are you a beer drinker, Lou?
Yes.
Might not want to waste your beer on the slugs, but...
One of the ways that folks oftentimes will try to deal with slugs is to kind of sink a pie pan into the ground, so the edge of the pie pan is right at the soil line, and then fill it with about halfway with some beer. And a real rich, yeasty beer is probably the best thing to use.
They like that yeast.
They like that. They get in there, and they get kind of disoriented from drinking the beer, and they drown. And that's the way of doing it.
Then you just dump out the pie pan and repeat the process. As much as it needs.
Or you can do what my dad does, which is go out with a flashlight each night, and he goes slug hunting, actually.
Big game hunt.
Yeah, and then he gives me a body count every weekend when I see him. So, and that probably is what's doing your hostas in, because slugs really love hostas.
Yeah. All right, so good luck to you, and thank you very much for calling. Paul in Milwaukee, we're on to you. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I've got a Seckel pear tree, and in the past, it's always produced delicious, disease-free, insect-free fruit. However, this year, the pears were covered with deep dimples, and underneath each one of those dimples was what I can only describe as a little stone. And I was wondering if you have any idea what that might be.
I think it might be plump curculio.
That was what I was thinking as well. I'm not an insect expert by any shot, but that's my thought.
They lay the eggs and it leaves a dimple, and you can actually see the adult egg laying leaves a little crescent mark in the fruit as well. There are various traps, I believe, and products that you can use to help with that.
Well, you might want to do this.
You've been lucky so far, let me tell you. for somebody to call up and say that a fruit tree has been
particularly
insect
a pear.
And disease. Yeah.
It has been for years. It's been a wonderful tree. And I was just astonished to see this because, you know, I'm not used to it. I'm always used to having beautiful fruit on this tree.
If you see it again, what I would recommend that you do, because we're just kind of speculating here, would be to get one of the fruits into your county extension office and have them take a look at it for you. And if they're not sure what it is, they can send it on to my counterpart in the insect world, who's Phil Pelletieri, who's been on Larry's show numerous times. And he can give you an ID and then can give you more specific recommendations on control.
Okay.
But from my perspective, I'm really shocked that you haven't seen any scab on your pears. That's
or
really
fire
amazing.
Blight.
Yeah, or fire blight.
No,
that would be the other one.
Wonderful. I'm an organic gardener, so if any, you know, if you have any like suggestions that wouldn't involve any chemicals, I would go to.
How many pear trees do you have?
Just the one. Just the one. There's another pear tree, you know, further down the block, and I imagine that those two are, you know, cross-pollinating.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, if it's one, you can bag them all, too, I suppose.
Yeah, that's...
You can bag all the pears.
Yes. And actually, someone in our group, Bob Tomish, actually gives classes on that every once in a while around the state. So.
What time of the year would these insects be, you know, attacking?
Oftentimes, it's relatively early, because the reason you're seeing that dimple there is because they're injuring the tissue before it's fully expanded. So they're coming in relatively early, making the damage, and then the fruit is kind of expanding around the injury.
Okay.
So it's not occurring right at maturity. It's earlier than that.
Okay.
I believe we have a... It's either a fact sheet or a publication.
I believe we
have
it's not a fact sheet. It's most likely a UW Extension publication. If you go to the following website, it's learningstore.uwex.edu.
Okay.
That's learningstore, all one word, .uwex.edu. And then type in Curculio in the search line.
Okay.
You can also just, where it says fruits, you can look up the publications, and there's one on growing pears in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that has all the likely
insect
bad actors.
Pests and
yeah.
disease problems
right.
in that. And
right.
that's got a lot of other sort of information on cultural control and just culture of pears, although it sounds like you're doing a wonderful job thus far. So my hat is off to you for not having any scab. I'm really amazed at that.
Okay, great.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
And we'll turn to Peter in Eau Claire next. Hi, Peter.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, thank you for calling.
Well, I have maybe a solution for the gentleman who had his lawn destroyed by the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
We have Rottweilers, and we have them in a pen, and it's all concrete. But what we've done is taken an old stump and put it off in one area, and then we always add more cedar chips to it. And both the male and the female always go into that area.
Gave them something to mark. Huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
That's a great idea.
That's smart.
And I was just wondering about where they've killed the grass, where it's been running, is just put the cedar chips down there.
You make a little path for them. That would be a good idea, too.
Make a little path, because if you put rocks out, it depends on the size of the dog, but one of my Rottweilers had to go in surgery and have a rock removed. He was a rock eater.
I've heard that too.
You want to make sure your dog's not a rock eater.
Oh my!
Thanks. Good points, Peter. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Those are good suggestions.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Anna in Fitchburg, it's on to you now. Hi, Anna.
Hi. We were very excited when we moved here from Chicago because we bought a lot where we had a lot of room to garden. But the problem is that the property backs up to a green space. And so we're using an existing garden that the previous owners had used, but it is completely overrun with weeds. And so the green space is full of grass plants and that type of thing. So I'm sure there's a ton of seeds.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm just wondering the best method of trying to cut down on the weeds without using a lot of chemicals.
Oh, boy.
My first thought was going to chemicals,
yeah,
quite frankly,
that
in that situation.
I Well, what I would recommend in general for that would be to spray everything with Roundup once the season gets going and the plants are growing rapidly, because then it's most effective and at that point in time. And then till the area and let the next set come up, and you can pull those if you prefer.
Well, let me tell you, though, having tried to do that in my own yard, it takes very little time before you're very, very tired of weeding.
Pulling weeds.
Yeah. Yeah, that gets really, really tiring.
What about some type of ground cover or landscaping fabric? Would that help?
You could try black plastic. I've seen people try to get at least some weeds under control by putting down a black tarp and then leaving it and allowing the plants to heat from the sun.
Old carpet.
Yeah, oftentimes that is a little bit problematic if we tend to have a lot of cloudy weather around here, so sometimes it doesn't get hot enough to really kill things off particularly well, but sometimes that can be useful as well.
It'll get the stuff on the surface, but it won't get the seeds,
They won't
though.
Get the seeds,
and so
yeah.
You'll still have the seed bank to deal with.
And you may
so
have
pretty
that,
much every year for the first few years, it'll be lots
gonna,
of Roundup.
You're going to have a problem.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Laura in Manitowoc, your turn. Hi, Laura.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about compost. I have a compost bin which is a couple of years old, and I admit I haven't been extremely vigilant with it, but we got one nice batch of compost out of it, filled it to the brim, and I was turning it, watering it, doing all of those things, and then, you know, of course, over last winter, I didn't touch it much, but in the spring when I went to turn it, it was just a mass of roots, and I'm suspecting, you know, it didn't get hot enough and do the compost thing. But I'm wondering, is there any way to rejuvenate that now? Can I revive it so that it will compost again, or do I need to just take it apart and start over?
Hmm.
Any suggestions?
Is this one of those plastic units that you turn, or are you saying it's just a bin?
It is a plastic unit with a cover, but it doesn't have, you know, it's not a drum where I can turn it. I have to turn it by hand with a pitchfork or...
Yeah.
And it's impossible to do that because the roots are just so... It's one mass.
Well, I'd just empty it out and...
And start again, I think.
Yeah.
I think that'll be the easiest thing to
do. The roots will die over the winter, most likely, unless you've got some perennial weed seeds in there. And then, you know, poke it apart a little bit in the spring and start over with that and fill up your bin as usual.
So you're saying, I mean, it's impossible to even turn it because it's such a mass. You're saying
expose
just
dump it.
Yeah.
Expose it.
Yeah.
And it'll winter kill.
Yeah, that's what I'm assuming. Now, you may have some perennial weeds in there that the roots won't die, and you'll have to take care of them next year, but it should kill off most of the annuals.
So just expose it to the elements, basically.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Good old Wisconsin winter.
assuming we have one of those.
Yeah.
It's hard to know.
All right, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. We finally have a couple of open lines, so you can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Barb in Merrill is up next, so let's go to Barb. Hi, Barb.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, we have a maple tree that we like, and so my husband just took the little propeller seedlings and stuck them in the ground in just some buckets, and they grew. We have about a dozen of them, and so they're probably all 6 to 8 inches tall, and we're wondering how to winter them. We thought maybe put them in a burlap sack and put them in the ground and then mulch them, or just leave them in those containers and stick them in the garage. We do have a heated garage and then just a regular garage, and I was wondering what your suggestion would be.
So they're not sunk into the ground now?
No, they're in a, you know, in a pot, you know,
okay, above ground.
A small pot?
No, they're, you know, like you would get a tree in, but we have several plants in the same pot.
Yeah.
Okay, you're in Merrill. Yeah.
Correct.
Think she
and
could,
on a very windy hill out in the country.
Think she should sink those maybe in the ground?
I think probably either method would work. Do you know what kind of maple it is?
No, I don't.
Okay. It would
it's
be good.
It's not a red or a white. It's a a lawn type of ornamental tree.
Normal.
Yeah, it could be a sugar maple. It could be a Norway.
Norway.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. I think that either one would fit. Probably putting them in the ground would be the best thing, because then you know they'll stay dormant. But if you don't get it done, if they're Norway maple seedlings, they'll probably survive just fine in the garage.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Although I don't know that I would put it in a heated garage. I think
would be more like a shed or something like that.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Do you think we should put them, if we put them in the ground, do you think put them in like a burlap sack?
So no. Just bury them in what you've got it in.
And put a little mulch around
them. Just bury the whole thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That
a little mulch around them, and
I think they'll do fine. Maples tend to be
pretty
hardy.
Mulching them too and cover them or not?
Just a little bit of mulch, and I would put a little fence around them.
Okay.
Just in case you have the kind of critters that we have down
rabbits.
Here. Yeah.
Probably some deer in that area too, I would guess.
Yes, we do.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. And Elizabeth in Washburn, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a suggestion. Now, I'm not really sure that this is what did it, but I think, and this is weeds in my vegetable garden, my tomatoes. I have a small garden since I moved in town here, but I put out about 2 dozen tomato plants every year. That gives me the tomatoes I need to can. And this year, I've always had a weed problem, just a terrible weed problem. This year, I got corn gluten meal. After I put my tomatoes in, I put corn gluten meal as a fertilizer around my tomatoes. They're far closer than they ever should be to begin with. But I have good tomatoes. I also trim them up to about 16, 18 inches above the ground every year, so there's always an open space underneath. And I had no weeds, absolutely not one weed. And corn gluten, and when I phoned the ag agent and told him that was what I went, he said, just put them around as a side dressing. Yes, it's fine. Don't put it any place where you have planted seeds.
Yes, exactly.
And, and I got to thinking, it must have inhibited all those weed seeds.
Yeah, corn gluten meal is what we would call a pre-emergent weed inhibitor, and it prevents seeds from germinating, which is why you want to be so careful about not putting it anywhere that you have seeds, your vegetable seeds, because it doesn't know the difference between a weed seed and a vegetable seed. And probably what it was killing off was mostly the annuals. There is a timing issue. You have to get it on before those seeds have germinated. After the seeds have germinated, then you're going to have as many weeds as usual. Usually corn gluten meal is only about 50% effective the first year. So hats off to you for not having any weeds.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you did with the tomato plants, trimming them up, that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I'm sure Brian would agree.
From the leaf spot and leaf blight
mm-hmm.
perspective that we talked about before, yeah, that's probably a good idea.
Yeah, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see, although there are some people who are against cutting the leaves off, one of our vicars of vegetables, as a matter of fact, Jim Nean, who hates to cut any leaf off.
Yeah. I mean, there's a fine line. There's a benefit and a cost to doing that, because you can potentially at least slow down the development of these leaf blights. On the other hand, if you don't have a lot of pressure for the disease, so you wouldn't naturally see it during the growing season, you're taking off leaf tissue that could be making nutrients that would go into fruit production. So, but, you know, oftentimes we see these leaf blights so commonly that I think it's a good idea. Just get those leaves away from the ground where they can become directly infected by the fungi. And you can slow the epidemic up quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. You bet. A couple of emails came in concerning the dogs in the lawn, and both are, at least the one is from Pam, who says she has a multi-dog house. So the dead spots aren't really dead. They're burned by mm-hmm. the urine, and we should have said that, actually. And those spots will come back next year, oftentimes greener and taller than the rest of the lawn. So she just teaches her dogs to go to a certain spot in the yard right now. And it makes a nice – she's got a nice little doggy bathroom she talks about. So that's one. And then the other from Tammy – she has her labs, Bailey, and Tess. She gives them vitamin C every day so they don't spot the lawn. The vet said to do 250 milligrams two times per day. She does 500 milligrams once a day, and she's very pleased with how it works. And I have heard this from a number of people.
Does it adjust the pH of the urine or something?
Well, I'm not sure exactly how it may work, but I have been told by... Well, there are several people out there who swear by that process, that they never have a problem again after they give their dogs the vitamin C. But I don't think there have ever been any clinical trials done on it. But, you know, sometimes if it works.
I see a federal grant somewhere.
Yeah.
Let's go to Marianne in Cedarburg next. Hi, Marianne.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
I have, about 6 years ago, I bought three gorgeous lilac bushes, one white, one light purple, and one dark purple. And they're in a row, plenty of room in between. But the dark purple, and they had a gorgeous, gorgeous bloom this year, best ever. And all of a sudden, midsummer, the dark purple one started getting some dead leaves, and I wasn't too concerned. But then the branches, it started to spread like to the whole branch. And in different places on the bush. So I cut the bad, you know, branches off and wondering if there's anything else I can do to save it.
You may not be able to save that shrub if it's what I'm thinking it is.
Oh, well.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I am the harbinger of death and doom here.
Oh, man.
Sorry about this.
So gorgeous.
Now, I may be wrong, okay? So I want to say that up front. But what I'm thinking about on a lilac with that sort of dieback that you're talking about, kind of a sectional dieback in the shrub, is a disease called verticillium wilt. It's caused by a soil-borne fungus that gets in through the root system and then blocks the water-conducting tissue inside the shrub. And that prevents water from getting from the root system up to the upper branches. And unfortunately, once the plant is infected, there's not much you can do about it. You will see a slow decline or a rapid decline, too. Depends on how much of the fungus is around and how many infections have occurred. But I do typically see a decline in infected trees and shrubs and eventual death. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
What about the other two bushes?
Well, again, I'm concerned about those as well, because what we oftentimes see is that the shrubs will grow fine for many, many years, and then all of a sudden they will end up with verticillium wilt. And I think what happens is that just as the shrubs are naturally producing new roots and expanding out into the soil, they encounter a patch of the fungus in the soil and they become infected. So there is some possibility that those other shrubs will become infected as well. Now, that's horrible, because I know you sound like you really love your lilacs.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah. On the other hand, if you do have problems with this particular problem, this particular disease, all hope is not lost, because there are other things you can put in that area that are quite attractive that are not susceptible to verticillium. And one of the trees or small shrubs that I oftentimes recommend are amelanchers or service berries. It's called an amelanker. The common name is service berry.
Or Juneberry.
And they are lovely little trees, small trees or shrubs. It depends on the particular variety. Lisa mm-hmm. can talk a little bit more about particular ones that she likes. But they look like a very, very delicate crab apple. And they bloom in the spring. They produce little fruits that are quite tasty, actually. You can use them in muffins.
If the birds don't get them first.
So
wonderful
that's,
fall color.
These are called Saskatoon service berries, is that
That's a type of amelanker.
Yeah.
And that's a more shrubby, small, larger fruited type that does tend to be very solaniferous and suckery. So if you want to keep it in one place, that might not be the one to... But that's, the same sort of thing. You know, the other thing, though, that occurred to me is it might be lilac borer.
Well, that could be, too. That's definitely
in which
a possibility.
Case, you know, check the... check at the base of the plant, make sure there isn't any small holes and frass, which is...
looks like sawdust.
Yeah, looks like sawdust at the base there. And if you do find a limb that's infected like that, you should remove it right at the base. And there are various insecticide products that you can use to try and prevent that. But I must say it does sound like verticillium.
Yeah,
too.
The other thing you need
both affect the vascular system.
And
so
it could be both, actually, quite frankly.
Isn't that wonderful?
Double dose.
What is spring without lilac?
I know it.
Saying don't replace them because the same thing's going to happen.
Yeah,
down the road.
If
not there anyway.
Yeah, certainly not in that area of your yard. I would move them to another location. The other thing you have to be very careful of as you're pruning off those dead branches is definitely decontaminate your tools. And I would dip them in 70% alcohol. So get some rubbing alcohol. Because verticillium has a very wide host range, and if you prune something that's infected and pick up the fungus on the pruning tools, you can actually inoculate other trees and shrubs as you prune elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Way too late for that one. Okay.
Well, no, again, I don't want you to go out and slit your wrists or something because you think you've killed all your trees. You're not likely to spread it a lot that way, but it's just a way that you can move this fungus around.
Good precaution.
So, and it's a very good precaution anytime you're pruning, because if you're cutting through any disease material, whether it's this particular fungus or another disease-causing organism, you can pick those organisms up on your tools.
All right.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Or no thanks, maybe.
Yeah,
I don't know.
No thanks.
You know, I heard a story where horticultural company was pruning a woman's hedge, and I believe she had, it was bacterial.
Oh, one of the bacterial diseases.
Yeah, the bacterial on lilac, and they inoculated the whole hedge because they weren't cleaning their pruning tools.
And it's even more important if you have bacterial diseases to do the decontamination, because there are so many of those bacteria in contaminated wood or contaminated leaves and it doesn't take many to infect. So definitely if you think you have a bacterial disease of any kind, decontaminate tools. You know, fire blight is the big one that I worry about on apples and pears and crab apples.
Yep. Thanks again for calling, Marianne. Appreciate your call very much. Someone else feeds their dogs tomato juice to cut the strength of the urine, probably the same sort of theory as with the vitamin C. I've heard the tomato juice mentioned many times, too. It's kind of an expensive way to do it, though. I mean, perfectly honest. Wendy in Oshkosh, your turn. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, thanks very much. Tomato juice is full of sodium. I wouldn't feed that to my dogs.
Yeah.
There's a high sodium content. Anyway, here's a question. I have an evergreen topiary that's quite tall. I had two of them. They're over 6 feet tall. I don't know what they're very common, and you always see the topiaries cut in this particular type of a shrub. I don't know if it's a yew. I'm not sure off the top of my head what it is. I had two. One of them died last year. The other one is still standing. So I put burlap around it, and then I put chicken wire, and inside the chicken wire I put all of my raked leaves sort of as an insulation. And now I'm worried that will there be some problem with diseases or fungus possibly in the leaves that could transmit. I don't know why the other one died last year. It was dead after the winter, so I thought, you know, I need to protect maybe this last one from the elements.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything wrong with putting a little bit of mulch or the leaf debris around the base of that tree. I would definitely make sure that I wouldn't do it too early in the fall. I would do it very late, and I would also make sure that I get out there very early in the spring and remove it early, because you don't want a lot of wet material against the main trunk, because that can provide a good environment for a lot of crown rot sort of organisms to get established. The other thing I worry a little bit about would be if you got mice in there, because that might be a wonderful little living area for them, and then they might sit and gnaw on the bark of the topiary underneath it. So you need to make sure that you're using small enough gauge wire that it doesn't allow the mice to get through.
And I wouldn't put the leaves in until after it's really frozen.
Everything is
frozen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, because so I just put the leaves in like yesterday, so you think it's too...
Take them back out.
Take them back out. It's a little wet yet. And the other thing that we ran into problems, are these planted in the ground or were they in pots?
No, they're in the ground.
They're in the ground. One of the things we had problems with, I think, a lot last year was that folks got snow so early that the ground didn't freeze, and it was relatively warm for soil temperatures. We had all that snow, and some of that's always kind of melting at the bottom, so the soil was relatively moist. And what you may have ended up in that one topiary is root or crown rot of some kind, because some of these organisms will actually still be active if we have unfrozen soil and relatively mild conditions, which we did, actually, under the snow at least.
Good luck. Thank you very much. But take those leaves out now.
Take those leaves out now and then put them back in a little later.
Brian Huddleston and Lisa Johnson, our guests here on the Ideas Network. Talking gardens here today with our two guests, Lisa Johnson and Brian Huddleston. Larry Mueller here. Let's go back to the phones, and John in Appleton is next.
Yes, try to extend the garden as much as I can. In fact, I'm out working in it right now. A little hard holding the phone with one hand, but one of the ways I do that is with a lot of container gardening, and I have a room in the basement with grow lights, cool temperatures, and all that. But some of these plants, I'm trying to, you know, by guess and by gosh here, figure out the various quirks of the different things that I'm trying to overwinter. And some of the things they say, well, it needs a period of dormancy. I believe snapdragons were one of those. They overwinter easily, but then they don't bloom worth a darn the next year. And, you know, what's that line between letting them go dormant and letting them die, I guess. do I keep them outside until it's 20 degrees, 10 degrees? Just where does that go?
It's going to depend on the plant. Snapdragons are fairly cold tolerant, so you might be able to get, you know, and it depends, too, also on the size pot that you're growing them in, and you know, the condition of the root system and so on. It's basically, you know, the roots that you're not going to want to let freeze. And I, digging through my brain here, trying to remember how long of a period of dormancy snapdragons would prefer. Often, you know, with the seeds, they'll suggest that before you plant them, that you put them in the refrigerator for a few days, like with pansies as well. And I am not coming up with a time on that, so I'm really not sure with the roots how long they would want that for. Got anything for us, Larry?
Let's see. Well, we may find something here. Let me ponder or work on that a little bit here, and I'll see if I can come up with something.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. We may have something here in a minute. Susie in Milwaukee, it is your turn. Hi, Susie.
Hi there.
Oh, it's Susie.
It's our Susie.
I know those two guys, and we should tell everybody again how wonderful they are and how lucky we are to have such good people in Wisconsin.
Well, and you the Milwaukee County Extension Office answering all those questions.
Anyway, you know, the woman with the roots in her compost pile.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to someone recently who was moving her compost pile and had a problem with roots, but she hadn't put any sticks or anything at the bottom. And she started it straight on the ground and had tree roots growing up into her compost.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I don't remember her saying, the woman that called you, saying that she had weeds or leaves or anything. So
just roots.
I just wonder. That might be something she should check and make sure that she keeps it up off the ground.
I should have asked that question because I was thinking it was a little odd that she didn't mention that she had plants or anything growing out of the compost pile as well with all those roots. So maybe they were tree or shrub roots that were growing out of the pile.
Yeah, that seemed like the tip-off. But, you know, you do diseases and things, so we can't expect you to know everything. And Lisa's a wonderful tree expert. If she recommends a tree to you, that's the one you want.
Okay.
Anyway, so just wanted to add that.
Thanks, Susie.
Thanks, Susie.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Appreciate the call.
Yeah,
All right.
I didn't even think of that. That's a good possibility there.
Linnea in Appleton, your turn. Hi.
Hi. How are you? Hello?
Hi.
Yes, yes.
Oh, sorry. We're here. My question is, me and my husband are first-time homeowners. We planted a huge flower garden, and I had to bring in black dirt. I thought it was good black dirt, but it ended up being very more like clay, and it is actually choking off several of my plants. Some of them are thriving. Some of them not so good, and I kind of would like to do some rearranging, but do I have to take all of my plants out to make this dirt better, or is there something I can do where I can leave most of my plants in place and just make the dirt looser and more healthy?
Oh.
You know, the best thing would probably be, if you would be willing to do it, would be to take things out and then incorporate organic material into the soil, so leaf mold or peat moss manure or anything of that sort.
Any of the organic materials, even if you haven't, you can use grass clippings if you haven't sprayed your lawn with anything. Like you said, the shredded leaves, any of that will help to lighten up the clay.
Okay. We did, the first year we did it, we mulched it over with bark, and I thought maybe that was helping keep too much moisture in there. Well, as that faded and went away, I decided not to put more down, but there's still some there. Will that eventually
that'll decay too. That'll be great. In fact, that is one way that we do try and improve soils. It takes one heck of a long time if you aren't, wanting to dig things up.
But I think if you're willing to dig up, that would probably be the quickest way to get the soil in better condition. And don't abandon the mulching, because once you have that organic matter incorporated into the soil, I think you probably will want a little bit of mulch on the top surface just to keep your weed problems down.
And to keep adding organic matter, because organic matter isn't something you can just add once and then forget about it. It does get used up in the soil, and it might take a couple of years or longer of additions before you have a really good soil to work with.
So good luck, and thank you very much for calling. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension horticulture educator, and Brian Huddleston, plant disease diagnostician with UW-Madison and UW Extension. Really happy to have them both with us. And we have lots of questions. Let's go back to the phones right away. And Brooke in Eau Claire has one for you. Hi, Brooke.
Hi. Slipped my mind now. Mulch. I'm a root stout fan, and she always advocated leaving all her old hay on the garden year round.
Yep.
And yet I hear how you should clean up the garden in the fall because it can hide diseases and organisms. So what is your thinking on that? And then a quick thing I do for slugs is they always get my hollyhocks in the spring. For the first time I got them, I worked in a little barn lime. That white powdery stuff, or even wood ashes would probably work. I worked it in around the plants. I did this a couple times, and they left them alone then. So I'll hang up and see what you say.
All right. Ruth Stout. Have you ever seen the movie Ruth Stout's Garden?
No.
It's a wonderful, it's an old, it goes way back, years back. She'd have a big pile of hay out there, and she said, "Well, now I'm going to go out and plant my potatoes." And she'd lift the hay up a little bit and throw the potatoes in and cover it back up, and that was it. And that's how she planted, and she liked to do it in the nude too, if I'm not mistaken. But she was really a wonderful gardener, and there are some wonderful old films and old books about Ruth Stout's garden. But the whole issue of mulch.
Really.
Google her sometime and take a look. But the whole question of this mulch business, Brian, what
about? Yeah, definitely I advocate using mulches. It's just what's the origin of the mulch, quite frankly. And at this time of the year, we do typically recommend trying to clean up in the garden, removing old plant material, particularly if you've had disease plants, because you definitely don't want that material sitting around, because that's where disease-causing organisms are going to survive. And if you're concerned about not having enough insulation by removing this material, then you can leave it over the winter if you want to, but you need to get out early in the spring before your plants begin to germinate and get that material out of your yard. The other sort of option is to go ahead and do the cleanup and then use other types of materials as your mulch. And you could put hay down as an insulation. I don't think I would leave that there, quite frankly, year round. I'm more of an advocate, if you're going to have permanent mulches, that they're a little bit more decorative. So the conifer mulches, shredded oak mulch, something of that sort to use.
Unless it's your vegetable garden.
Definitely in amongst ornamentals. A couple of the mulches that I'm a little bit cautious about, if you're in a larger community that has kind of a municipal mulch pile where they take their street trees and grind them up and make that material available for homeowners, I'm a little bit leery of that material because many of our street trees, like maples and ashes, are susceptible to verticillium. And the trees that the cities are grinding up are typically the trees that are dead or dying. And so I worry about that municipal mulch as being a source of verticillium or other disease-causing organisms. And then the other type of mulch that I have a little bit of a concern about is cocoa bean mulch. With that particular mulch. I'm concerned about it being contaminated with a particular fungus that causes a very aggressive disease called southern blight that will basically, that particular fungus will take out anything herbaceous that's in its path. So getting that established in your garden is definitely not a good thing. But in general, I like mulches. If you use the appropriate amount, don't overdo it. About 2 to 4 inches of most mulches, if you're trying to get good weed control and keep water retention, up to 2 inches on a clay soil, up to 4 inches on a sandier soil.
That coca bean mulch, I might also add, is poisonous to dogs if they eat it.
I don't find it lasts that long either. It smells really good when you first spread it, but after about probably 2 or 3 weeks, it starts to mold quite badly. And that's not necessarily a disease-causing organism. That's just a decay organism.
Yeah, you can rake that out if you want the extra headache.
Right. But I like some of the conifer mulches because I think they smell good. They last a long time, and you don't have to continually reapply them.
I don't recommend cypress mulch, though, because Nature Conservancy has done some research and found that in some cases the cypress, which comes from bald cypress, that they're getting it out of old-growth cypress swamps and basically ravaging the ecosystem. So you probably don't want to be supporting that.
And I tell you what, I just looked up Ruth Stout. She lived from 1884 to 1960, and she was one of 9 children. And she mulched. She just started gardening and realized she didn't want to dig, so she never dug. She just used mulch, and she used hay primarily, but she'd throw other kinds of grass clippings and so forth in as well. And she kept the hay kept the ground so moist. It says here that she did not. She claimed that she did not water her garden for 35 years.
Interesting.
So she was a very interesting interesting person.
Where did she garden?
Let's see. Where was she from? I've forgotten now where she's from.
So I'm wondering if the soil had good natural
Kansas.
Drainage.
Kansas. She lived in Kansas. So, she was actually, when she was 18, she moved to New York City, and at the age of 45, she married and moved to the country and began gardening the hard way, according to the gardening experts of her day, and she got sick of digging, so she just started using mulch. Oh, it's a great story. Mary and Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I'd like to ask 2 questions about beneficial fungus with trees, and I wonder if that applies to shrubs and all woody plants, and also geography and species of these fungus or fungi. Like in our area, are there different species of symbiotic fungus?
Okay. Yeah. There are what are called mycorrhizal species that have an interaction, a symbiotic relationship with tree and shrub roots. And there are, you know, different species that colonize different types of woody plant roots.
And herbaceous plants as well.
I mean, yeah,
yeah,
right.
Orchids, a lot of native orchids require mm-hmm. mycorrhizal fungi as well.
Yeah, and the herbaceous plants have others as well. If you look some of the stuff up on the internet, they have some really fascinating pictures. And what these fungi do is they enable the roots to be able to collect nutrients more easily, to be able to get water more easily. And they give a home to the fungus so that it's a win-win. And there are some products out there where some of this cutting-edge stuff is being done. If you look at the work of Dr. Elaine Ingham, there's some really interesting work that's being done with the soil food web and actually with compost teas with some good scientific data behind it. On mycorrhizals, but it's the stuff that is available in the typical consumer market. I haven't seen much research on to see whether that stuff is like I've seen some packaged products that say, oh yes, we've got, you know, such and so how many ever species of beneficial fungi and bacteria, and I haven't seen any good studies on how that powdered stuff works, because I know that in the past it wasn't very successful.
I asked Laura Jahl, who's our woody ornamental specialist, about using mycorrhizal fungi on existing established trees, mm-hmm. and she wasn't really that in favor of it. She said all the research that she had seen indicated that trying to make mycorrhizal applications after the fact really wasn't beneficial.
Wasn't beneficial.
Mm-hmm. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there you have it, Mary.
Yeah, it's quite interesting. There was a, I can't remember the name of the researcher. She was out of the University of Kansas, who was working on mycorrhizal fungi on wheat, of all things, and found out normally, traditionally, wheat is a mycorrhizal plant. And, but what she found was that varieties that were developed post-World War II with the advent of a lot of fertilization, adding chemical fertilizers, they found out that those particular plants had been bred to the point where even if you grew them in poor fertility soils and the mycorrhizal fungi were there, they no longer formed the mycorrhizal associations. Particularly, that's one of the reasons probably why some of our more modern wheat varieties don't necessarily work well in third world countries, because there's not a lot of fertilization there, and they don't form these relationships. And particularly phosphorus uptake is important, an important aspect of mycorrhizal fungi.
We had an email from Lynn, who planted a small tree last year and then another smaller tree this year, about 3/4 to an inch in diameter. This summer, they got a lot of rain in a week's time. Then the tree started to lean a little bit, then some more, and they thought about staking, but after reading on the internet, it looks like most of the advice is against it. I'd say the trees are leaning 10 to 15%. Should we stake the trees for a while, and what other choices do we have? And, you know, you can't believe everything you hear on or read on the internet.
Yeah. I'd say if the trees are that small, if they had come in pots, you might want to actually dig them up in the spring and reposition them. Particularly, we see this sort of thing when, like you said, when we get a lot of rain, or if the root ball of the tree is sitting on, not on the bottom of the hole, but on top of some prepared soil, or if you added a little soil at the bottom of the hole, we often get leaning. And from the amount that you're saying that your tree is leaning, I'm not sure that staking alone is going to correct that. Usually, you know, if you have a real whippy small tree, there's no problem with staking it the first year. But usually you don't want to stake it more than that, and you don't want to stake it so tightly that the tree doesn't have any wiggle room to move with the wind, because actually that will help the girth of the tree to develop and to make it a stronger tree if it has that wiggle room. But again, we had a couple of real leany trees on our teaching garden site, and we tried staking, and they had been planted incorrectly a number of years ago. And, when you have an opportunity like this to correct it right away, that is what I would recommend, since they're so small. If they were 2-inch trees, well,
yeah,
maybe
been
we'd
in the ground for a while.
Yeah. Right. You have anything to add
to
that?
No, that would be my recommendation, too. Since they've so recently been transplanted, I would dig them out and put them, replant them.
All right. Eric in La Crosse, we're on to you now. Hi, Eric.
Hello. I have a question about an ash tree. That's it's an older ash tree, probably about it's very tall, about 60 feet, I would guess. And about 20 feet up, it goes into a Y, and at that Y, it's cracked down the center. And the crack goes down, probably 7 feet or so. So my question is it worth it to cut off one side of that Y, and will the tree heal then, or is it just too susceptible to disease? Should I just take the whole tree down?
Oh, boy. This is one of those where I for liability purposes, because I can't actually see the tree, but it sounds like a really large limb that you would be removing. And I would recommend having a certified arborist look at it and evaluate it. There are different gradations of how much of a hazard it is. But usually if you have a crack that's that big, that tree is a danger, and I would my recommendation without seeing it would probably be to take it down. But again, you should have a certified arborist take a look at it. Also,
okay.
Cracks like that are just great entryways for diseases and insects. And I'm sure,
yeah.
Brian.
Sure.
And that would have been my recommendation. Is my recommendation as well, is to call a certified arborist. And are you hooked up to the internet?
Yes.
Let me give you a website where you can look up arborists. It's www.waa-isa.org. That's the website for the Wisconsin Arborist Association. And
Okay. On
that website, there'll be a searchable section where you can look up certified arborists in your area and definitely have someone come out and evaluate that tree.
Yeah, okay. Don't park your car near.
Or have your children or pets or neighbors or anything else near that tree for a while.
Thanks, Eric, for calling. Good luck. Brian in Lake Villa, Illinois, we're on to you now. Hi, Brian.
Hi. Turn the radio down.
What can we do for you?
Good morning.
If I am trying to give my trees some late season water, is it better to use a soaker hose around the trees? Now, these are big trees, maybe 40 feet high. Could I just set the hose at maybe six different spots around the tree with a moderate flow of water and move the hose maybe every 10 minutes or so?
What sort of trees are you talking about?
Mainly maples, silver maples.
Have they lost their leaves already?
They've pretty much lost their leaves.
I wouldn't advocate giving them any water at this point in time. Usually we recommend that you water up to the point when they start to lose their leaves. And my personal recommendation is to use a soaker hose. I think you'll get better, more uniform coverage with water with a soaker hose rather than a regular hose.
Now, if you have some evergreens, that's a different
matter. You could continue to water those up until the point when you either get a real heavy snow or it freezes, the ground freezes.
And probably should, because they are more likely to dry out.
Particularly yews. I see real problems with them dehydrating over the winter time, and you need to make sure they have enough internally stored water before they go into the winter to keep them through. And actually, we had a lot of problems with this last winter because the winter was so long.
Mm-hmm. You're talking evergreens.
Evergreens, definitely, yeah.
Can I just put the hose at the base of the tree?
I would still use a soaker hose even with the evergreens. I think it'll work better for you out near the drip line. If you can only water in one area, I would concentrate at the drip line.
Mm-hmm. How long would you leave a soaker hose around there?
What I normally recommend personally, and Lisa, jump in if you have other ideas, is to take something like a little tuna can or something like that and bury it down to the lip at the soil line, and then put a section of your soaker hose over that. And I usually recommend roughly about an inch of water per week for established trees and shrubs. And you can just measure when you get about an inch of water in that can. Or you can use a pie pan or something like that as well.
Okay.
Can I ask one other question?
Sure.
Is it too late to plant a big mum, maybe 20, 24 inches across?
And have it survive?
So you're in Lake Villa, Illinois, so you're on the, what zone is that? Probably too late anyway.
Yeah,
what can I do with it?
Well, you can try cutting it back and growing it inside as a house plant over the winter, and you'll probably have to repot it because most of those are pretty pot bound, and then planting it in the spring. It's unfortunate because, you know, mums do bloom so beautifully in the fall that that's when we tend to buy them. But usually, unless you buy them early in the season when they're sold, they often will not overwinter, at least in our area here. We're zone 5. Usually they don't get rooted in well enough. And if you buy the smaller ones in the spring, then they will, of course. But sometimes you'll have to pinch off the flower buds. But it's just, it's the way the marketing goes, and it's perfectly understandable that they're not selling huge mums in the spring. But hard to get them to overwinter.
But they do make a wonderful indoor plant. I've certainly purchased them in the fall and held them over for quite a while. I don't necessarily plant them outdoors in the spring, but if I would continue to water them properly, I could keep them alive and have them outside. But that's my personal problem with houseplants. But I think you could keep it alive inside very well over the winter and probably have a very nice houseplant.
Yep.
And if it's been outside for a while now, I probably would use some insecticidal soap on it before you bring it in with your other house plants, because you may have spider mites or some other critter on it that you don't want to bring in with your other plants.
What did you say I should put on?
Insecticidal soap.
Insecticidal soap.
Especially concentrating under the leaves, because that's where the critters hang out.
Great. Well, thank you all so much.
Yep, thank you for calling. Bob in Marshfield, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Say, I've been seeing a lot of creeping bent grass in lawns, including mine, all the way from Marshfield up to the UP. What's the best way to manage that? And I'll take your answers off the air.
All right.
Oh, boy.
I'm sorry. I'm not a turf expert.
I'm
so
not
that's...
really a turf expert either. I can almost see that publication, though, that John Steyer wrote about it.
What we might want to do is refer him to the website, the Extension Publications website.
Right, the Learning Store.
Yeah, this is learningstore.uwex.edu. And just in the search line, I would just type in either turf or grass, and you'll get a list of publications, and you should be able to scan down there and find one that has to do with
bent grass
control. So, sorry, we can't answer that on the air here, but
it is a problem. I know I've heard Ann talking to people about it a number of times.
So there you have it, Bob. Take a look at go to the Learning Store, UW Extension Learning Store, and you can find out a little bit more from that, from John Steyer's publication. We had an email from Bonnie in Bear Valley. Just came in from garden cleaning up and was delighted to find my arugula still growing vigorously. Are there any other greens this hardy?
I'm assuming it was probably mulched.
Probably under
mulch. The Swiss chard is pretty tough. Spinach, in fact, they're both of those are usually even sweeter after a frost or two. Mm-hmm. And if you grow them in a cold frame, you can keep them going for quite some time in the winter, depending on where you're located.
Other types of brassicas do very well in cold temperatures as well. So cabbages and Brussels sprouts and that sort of thing will oftentimes stick around very late in the season.
Courtney in Appleton wonders, what is the fastest growing shrub that will make a good shrub wall at least 3 feet high that I can plant immediately? I live in Appleton. Nothing.
immediately, huh?
Decorative fencing might be a better option.
Yeah, I just don't think you're going to be able to find a whole lot in the nurseries at this point in time.
Not now. It's going to have to wait. You're going to have to wait till spring, I'm afraid.
Right, and I wouldn't be planting anything now anyway.
Yeah, it's dicey.
About survival.
Yeah.
Jim in Waukesha, hello.
Hi. About 15 years ago, moved into a house and had a nice deck off the side, but it was just so exposed to the front yard and the sidewalk and the street that we wanted to shield it some. So I planted six Techne cedars around the this deck is well off the ground. It's 6 feet off the ground. It took them a while to grow, but now they've really gotten wild. One particularly, the one that gets the most sun, is about 15 feet tall. I'd like to. Others have not grown nearly as much because they don't get as much sun. I think that's what it is. They also get a little woody down below where they don't get the sun. But can I top these off, or what should I do to try to keep this, particularly the biggest ones, under control?
You can top them off. It's not going to look very good.
Yeah.
The deal with arborvitaes is that if you cut into the what we call the brown zone, which is directly under, you know, if you part the foliage and you see the area where the green growth stops, if you cut into that area, you will not get any growth that returns. So it's a little difficult to make really big changes, on, especially if the plant is not in very much sun, it tends to have an even thinner green zone. And it's just, you pretty much have to keep up with it from the beginning in order to make
make it work. And with that, we're going to have to conclude. You could lop them off, but off the top, but
they're
it's not going to look very good.
Not going to look very good.
And on that happy note,
I'm not the only one that's the harbinger of death. Okay, good.
Brian and Lisa, thank you so much for being with us today. Look forward another visit.
Thanks, Larry.
Brian Huddleston, plant disease diagnostician with UW Extension, and Lisa Johnson, Dane County UW Extension horticulture educator. Our guests, welcome back. We'll do it again. And thank you for listening. And please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.